This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Ranger's Apprentice, The Royal Ranger, Book 2, The Red Fox Clan, by John Flanagan. Read for you by John Keating. Prologue. He stood in the shadows to one side, letting the rage build within him. He needed the rage. He fed off it. It inflamed the passion and fire that went into his words and his delivery. Audiences felt it and reacted to it. He had the ability to arouse the same rage in them. His audiences were, for the most part, unsophisticated country folk and villagers. And he used all the tricks of the rabble-rouser's trade to play upon their prejudices and intolerance, to make them raise their fists to the heavens and cry for justice. The basis for his own rage was simple. In his mind, he had been cheated out of his birthright, his right of inheritance. And it had been done at the whim of a monarch who sought to cement his own family's succession to the throne. At the stroke of a pen, he had changed a centuries-old law of the land and decreed that, in Araluen, a female heir could succeed to the throne. Most Araluans accepted the new law without thinking, but a small number of fanatics and conservatives resented it. They formed the Red Fox Clan, a subversive group with the avowed aim of bringing back the old ways, the law of male succession. The Red Fox Clan had been few in number when he had first discovered them several years ago, with perhaps fewer than 50 members. But he had seen them as the key to attaining his destiny, the throne of Araluen. He had recognized that this movement, weak and unorganized as it was, could become the base from which he could launch his campaign. Accordingly, he had joined them, bringing his undoubted talent for organization and leadership to their movement. He had traveled from village to village, from town to town, preaching his message of prejudice in clandestine meetings, biding his time, and watching the number of clan members grow. That initial group of fewer than 50 now numbered in the hundreds. They were a powerful and well-financed movement, and he had gradually risen to the position of Vulpus Rutilus, the Red Fox, leader of the clan. He was a skilled and convincing orator, but that was only one aspect of his complex character. He could be hard and ruthless when he needed to be, and on more than one occasion, he brutally crushed people who defied him or tried to impede his way to the top. But, just as important, he had learned at an early age that a more effective way to achieve his ends was by charm and apparent friendliness. His mother had told him as a boy, when she dinned into his brain the injustice that had been done to him, "You catch more flies with honey than vinegar." And he had applied that lesson well as he grew in years and maturity. He had cultivated the ability to make others like him, to convince them he was their friend. A consummate actor, he had learned to hide animosity behind an outer show of warmth and geniality, and a winning smile. Even now, there were half a dozen people in the upper ranks of the Red Fox Clan whom he hated. Yet not one of them was aware of the fact, and all of them regarded him as a friend, a warm and generous ally. And there were others, those outside the cult, people he viewed as his most bitter adversaries, who had no idea of the depths of hatred that simmered below his outer layer of easygoing cordiality. Now the time was approaching when he could cast that pretense aside and reveal his true feelings, and he felt a deep sense of satisfaction at the thought of it. The meeting was being held in a large clearing in the woods, between three large villages where he had recruited members to the clan. He scanned them now. Only clan members had been invited, and a screen of guards armed with clubs and swords were in place, to make sure that no outsider would witness the meeting. There were nearly 100 people present, an excellent turnout. In the beginning, he had spoken to audiences of fewer than a dozen people. People who were only half interested in what he had to say, but were looking for some diversion from their drab, humdrum lives. The movement had gathered its own momentum and energy. There was an expectant buzz among the crowd as they waited for him to speak. He judged that it was time to do so. The past few years had seen him develop a sense of timing when dealing with crowds. He had the ability to know when he should appear, and then to wait those vital few minutes longer, until expectancy had turned into eagerness and enthusiasm for the cause. There was a raised speaking platform to his left, lit by flaring torches, and with a backdrop bearing the face of a red fox. He donned his mask now, a stylized fox face that covered his eyes, nose, and cheeks. He pulled the fur-trimmed scarlet cloak tighter around his body, and mounted the three low steps at the back of the stage, pushing through the backdrop to appear, almost magically, in the flaring torchlight. There was a moment's silence as he appeared, then shattering applause as he threw his arms wide, with the scarlet cloak spread behind him. "My friends!" he shouted, having waited just the right amount of time so that the applause was beginning to ebb but was not yet completely silent. Now it died away as they waited for his words. He spoke, his voice ringing out, reaching to those at the very back. "For thousands of years, our country was guided by a law that said only a male heir could succeed to the throne. It was a good law. It was a just law. And it was a law that respected the will of the gods." A rumble of approval ran through the crowd. He wondered briefly why they accepted so readily the concept that this was a law approved by the gods. But they did. They always did. It was part of that big lie that he had created. The lie that, told often enough, became truth in the minds of those listening. "Then, some years ago, a king decided, without any consultation or discussion, that he could change this law. With the stroke of a pen, he changed it, arbitrarily and arrogantly." He stepped forward to the front of the stage and leaned toward his audience, his voice rising in pitch and volume. "Did we want this law changed?" He paused, and the expected result came. "No!" roared the crowd. If they hadn't responded, he had people planted through their ranks who would have led the cry of protest. "Did we ask for this law to be changed?" "No!" The response echoed around the clearing. "So why did he do it?" This time, he continued immediately. "To secure the succession of his own family. To ensure that his granddaughter would inherit the throne. And her daughter." When the king had changed the law, his granddaughter was yet to be born. But people were willing to overlook hard facts in the height of their passion. "Was he right to do it?" "No!" "Was it just?" "No!" "Or was it an act of selfish arrogance and total disregard for the people of this kingdom?" "Yes!" He paused, letting their fervour die down a little, then resumed in a lower, more reasonable tone. "Can a woman lead this country in time of war?" He shook his head. "No, she cannot. A woman isn't strong enough to stand up to our enemies. What does a woman know about war and military matters and holding our borders secure?" This time, he held out his hands, prompting an answer, and got it. "Nothing! Nothing!" "Then, my friends, the time has come for us to act upon what is right. To change this unjust, this unasked for, this godless law back to the old law of this land. Are you with me?" "Yes!" they shouted. But it wasn't enough for him. "Are you all with me?" Will we go back to the old way? The right way? The way of the gods? Yes! Their roar of agreement was so deafening that they woke the starlings roosting in the trees around the clearing. Vulpus Rutilus turned away to hide his smile of triumph. When he had his features under control, he turned back, speaking now in a low voice that had them craning forward to listen. "Well, my friends, now is the time for the Red Fox clan to rise up. In 2 months' time, we will gather at Araluin in Fief, and then I will give you your orders." 1. They were coming closer to Maddie's hiding place. There were a dozen of them, spread out in a long cordon, 5 meters apart and covering 60 meters of territory. Each one carried a flaming torch, holding it high to dispel the gathering gloom of twilight. She was approaching the line of searchers head on. If she could break through the line, or simply remain unseen while they passed her, she would be free and clear. Actually, hiding place was something of an overstatement for Maddie's position. She was simply lying prone, covered from head to toe by her cloak, among knee-high, dried stalks of grass. In the fields on either side of the one she had selected to hide in, the grass grew waist-high, waving gently in the early evening breeze. It would have provided better concealment from the dozen men searching for her, but she had chosen the shorter grass for a reason. They would expect a fugitive to seek concealment in the longer grass, so they would look more carefully there. The short stubble where she lay provided only scant cover, and the searchers would study the ground with less attention to detail, assuming they would easily spot someone trying to stay concealed there. At least, that was what she hoped when she had selected her current path through the search line. In addition, the fields on either side were narrower, so the searchers would be closer together. Since they'd expect her to be hiding there, they would pay greater attention to the ground and any abnormalities they might see there. Like a huddled shape under a grey-green ranger cloak. The uncertain light also gave her an advantage. The sun had sunk below the horizon, and only a reflection of its light remained in the western sky. It cast long shadows and pools of darkness across the rough surface of the field, and instead of aiding the searchers, the light from the pitch-fed torches was flickering and uneven, making their task even more difficult as it shifted and wavered. She could sense the yellow glow of one of the torches now, as a searcher came closer. She resisted the unbearable temptation to look up and see where he was. Her face was darkened by the mud and grime she had smeared on it before setting out to break through the cordon. But even so, it would shine as a pale oval in the dusk, and the movement would be even more noticeable. She lay, face down, her eyes fixed on the stalks of dry grass a few centimetres from her face, seeing the yellow torchlight creeping over them, casting shadows that gradually shortened as the source of light grew closer and closer. Her heart pounded in her chest as she heard the rustle of boots. She could hear the blood pulsing in her ears like a drumbeat. "Trust the cloak," the old mantra, drummed into her brain over and over by her mentor, repeated itself now. The searcher couldn't hear her heartbeat. That was a fanciful notion, she knew. And if she stayed still as a corpse, he wouldn't see her either. But cloak would protect her. It always had in the past, and it would do so now. "All right, I see you. Stand up and surrender." The voice was very close. It couldn't have been more than 3 meters away, and there was a confident tone to it. For a second, she nearly gave in to the urge to stand, But then she remembered Will's words when he'd been instructing her in the art of remaining unseen by searchers. They may try to trick you into showing yourself. They might call out that they can see you and tell you to stand up. Don't fall for it. So she lay motionless. The voice came again. Come on! I said I can see you! But the voice wasn't as confident as it had been. There was a distinct uncertainty to it, as if the searcher realized the ruse had been unsuccessful, or that there was nobody near him concealed in the rough grass. After a few more seconds, he muttered a soft curse and began to move again. His boots crunched in the stubble, and she sensed he had passed her by, which meant he was casting his gaze ahead of him and away from her. She watched the tiny shadows thrown by the grass stalks elongate and angle to the left. He was moving to the right then. She realized she'd been holding her breath and silently released it, feeling the tension in her body ease. Her heart rate slowed from its wild gallop to a more controlled canter. In a few minutes, he'd be clear of her, and unable to hear any slight noise she might make moving. She waited, counting slowly to 120, listening as the rustle of his boots moved away until she could no longer hear them. She tensed her muscles. When she had gone to ground, her left arm had been thrown out ahead of her. Her right was doubled underneath her body, and she would use that to help her rise from the ground a few centimetres and begin to creep slowly away from her hiding spot. She began to apply pressure to her right hand, feeling the sharp grass stalks digging painfully into it. It would have been so natural to move her hand slightly to a more comfortable position, but again she resisted temptation. Unnecessary movement might give her away. Better to put up with the discomfort. Of course, she'd have to move her arm to propel herself along the ground in a belly crawl, but that was a necessary movement. Otherwise, she'd be here all night. So she began to set her muscles once more, then stopped. There had been a sound, faint and unrecognizable, from the grass in front of her. And as she registered it, she remembered another piece of advice that Will had given her. Sometimes there'll be a sweeper. She could hear his calm voice saying in her brain. Another searcher who follows the line, 10 or 12 meters behind it, looking to catch someone who's evaded the first line and is beginning to move again. It's an old trick, but you'd be surprised how many have been caught by it. She relaxed again and waited, head close to the ground, face down. Now she heard the sound again, and this time she recognized it. Whoever was coming was lifting his feet high out of the grass, then setting them down evenly and squarely on the ground, testing each step so it didn't shuffle or create extra noise. It was the way she had been taught to step when she wanted to keep noise to a minimum, and she realized that this new arrival was well skilled in the art of silent movement. She strained her ears, listening for any trace, any sound, that would tell her how close he was and which direction he was coming from. He seemed to be slightly to her right and moving diagonally, so that he would cross close by her position. And so far, she could see no sign of light from a torch. She bit her lip with frustration. A torch would have given him uncertain, uneven light, which would actually help conceal her. Plus, the brightness of the flame close to his face would reduce his night vision considerably. Now that it was nearly full dark, a torch was almost more hindrance than help. He was close. Even with the care he was taking to keep noise to a minimum, she could hear the faint sounds that he made. His stepping smoothly and rhythmically helped her keep track of him. Once she figured out his timing, she knew when to listen for the next, almost silent, footstep. Now he was very close, but he was moving across her front, angling to pass down her left side, and she knew she had eluded him. She felt a surge of triumph as he took another pace, taking him fractionally away from her. Three more steps in that direction, and she'd be in the clear. Then, inexplicably, he angled back again, changing direction to move parallel to where she lay. Her heart rate soared again as she realized how close he was to finding her. She felt a searing pain in her left hand as he placed his foot squarely on it, bearing down with all his weight as he raised his other foot for another step. "Ow!" she cried before she could stop herself. At the same time, she inadvertently flinched with the pain, just as he recoiled a pace, sensing a foreign object underfoot. It was only a small movement on her part, but it was enough. The sweeper gave a cry of triumph, and she felt an iron grip on the back of her cloak, just below the cowl, hauling her to her feet. "Got you," he said, the satisfaction obvious in his voice. He turned her to face him, at the same time that he called to the search line. "Back here! I've got him!" He pushed her hood back and studied her face more closely. "But you're not a him, are you?" he said. "You're Will Treaty's apprentice." "Well, you are a catch, and no mistake." She struggled in his grip, hoping to break free, even though the exercise was now well and truly over. The rest of the searchers, hearing his shout, hurried back and gathered round them, the torchlight showing their grinning faces all too clearly. "Bad luck," said one, a handsome fourth-year apprentice. "You nearly made it." He jerked his head to the edge of the field, and she twisted in her captor's grip to look. The little hut she had been tasked to reach was barely 50 meters away. If it hadn't been for this clod-hopping sweeper with his clumsy great feet, she would have made it. And that would have given her a perfect score for her end-of-year assessment. On a low hilltop 100 meters away, Will Treaty and Gillen watched the events in the stubble field as the searchline gathered around Maddie and her captor. Even at this distance, and in the gathering dark, the torchlight gave sufficient illumination for Will to see Maddie's dejected, frustrated reaction. "That was bad luck," Gillen said. "She nearly made it, and she did everything right. Right up until the moment she went, 'Ow, you trod on me,'" Will grinned. Gillen looked sidelong at his old friend. "As I said, that was bad luck." "Holt always said a ranger makes his own luck," Will replied. "If I didn't know better, I'd think you were pleased she was caught," Gillen said. Will shrugged. "I'm not too displeased," he admitted. "She was set for a perfect score, and I'm not sure I wanted that. It wouldn't have been good for her ego." He paused slightly. "Or my patience." "I take it you speak from experience?" Gillen asked. Will nodded. "She got a perfect score at the end of second year," he said. "And I heard about it for the next 3 months. Any time I tried to correct her or suggest that she might be going about a task the wrong way. She does tend to be a little headstrong." Gillen nodded. "True. But she is very good, you have to admit." "I admit it. But she's also her mother's daughter. Can you imagine how Evelyn would have been in her place?" This time, Gillen grinned at the thought. "You're referring to Her Highness Princess Cassandra in that derogatory tone, are you?" He was mildly amused by the fact that Will continued to refer to the princess by the name she had assumed when he first met her. Will shook his head ruefully. "I am indeed," he replied. The more I see of Maddie, the more I see her mother in her. Which possibly explains why she is such a high achiever, Gillen suggested, and Will had to agree. True. He stood up from where he had been sitting, leaning against the bole of a tree. The search party and their quarry were heading back to the gathering ground, the line of torches twinkling in the darkness. "Let's get back to camp and sit in on the debrief," he said. 2. The analysis of Maddie's performance was held in one of the large central command tents. The three senior assessors sat behind a trestle table, in comfortable canvas folding chairs, studying reports from the assessors who had examined her skills and abilities over the course of the gathering. Maddie stood before them, with her captor a half pace behind her. The assessors glanced up as Will and Gillen entered the tent, lifting the canvas flaps to the side. Harlan, the most senior, nodded permission for them to come in. Will was Maddie's mentor, of course, so he had every right to be here and listen as they passed judgment on her performance. And Gillen, as commandant of the Ranger Corps, was entitled to go anywhere he pleased. In the time it had taken for the two to reach the tent, the panel had listened to the report from Maddie's captor. Now Harlan spoke.
"Unfortunately, we can't give you a pass on your unseen movement exercise," he said.
His voice was not unkind. He was impressed with the overall level of Maddie's performance, as accounted in the written reports of those who had tested her. He glanced down at the reports fanned out in front of him. "Shooting, excellent," he read, and he noted an addendum to the report. Unlike the other apprentices, Maddie had been assessed for her skill with the sling as well as the bow, and he raised his eyebrows as he saw that her scores over half a dozen tests averaged 95%. She was even better with the sling than with the bow, where she had scored an impressive 92%. Knife throwing, excellent. Unarmed combat, very good. Map making, another excellent result. Navigation skills, above average. And since average in the Ranger Corps meant excellent, that was saying something. Tactical planning, excellent. He leafed through the papers, seeing more excellent and above-average ratings. He was impressed, and he knew his colleagues were as well. Third-year assessments were tough. It was the time when the examiners really began to bear down on the apprentices. They were more than halfway through their training, and they were expected to keep a high standard. He glanced up and caught Will Treaty's eye as the grey-bearded ranger stood just inside the entrance to the tent. It wasn't surprising that she had performed so well, he thought. Will Treaty was one of the most accomplished members of the Ranger Corps, and he'd been trained by Halt, a legend among the green and grey-cloaked community. Harlan switched his gaze now to the slightly built figure before him. Maddie had tossed back her cowl, and her short hair was tousled. There were even one or two wisps of dead grass caught in it. She stood erect, facing him with a look of determination, even defiance, on her face. She was slightly flushed, he noticed, angry at being caught so close to her objective. He assumed correctly.
"Overall, you've done well, Madeline," he said. "Aside from the unseen movement exercise, you've pretty well topped the course."
He indicated the report sheets in front of him. His two companions, with copies of their own, grunted their agreement.
"Your results are more than good enough for you to advance to fourth-year training," he said.
And he saw a slight relaxation of her shoulders as she heard that piece of news. Then, after a second or two, she stiffened once more, and her jaw set in a stubborn line. He gathered the reports together, tapping them on the table to align them, and continued.
You'll take a makeup assessment for unseen movement in 3 months or so, he told her. I'm sure you'll have no trouble passing it.
It's not fair. Maddie blurted the words out, unable to contain herself any longer.
Harlan set the rearranged reports down on the table and raised an eyebrow at the angry face before him. Not fair? How is it not fair? You were caught 50 meters from your objective.
But it's a test of unseen movement, she protested. And he never saw me. He trod on my hand.
Are you saying you weren't apprehended?
Harlan asked quietly.
Maddie, now committed to her protest, went on.
I'm saying I wasn't seen. She swung round and gestured to her captor. The very fact that he stood on my hand proves it. He had no idea I was there. It was a test of unseen movement, and he never saw me.
Until you cried out and moved, Harlan said. Then he saw you.
She shook her head in defiance. It wasn't a test of being trodden on, she said, aware that the words sounded ridiculous, but unable to think of another way to frame them.
It was a test of your ability to remain concealed, Harlan pointed out. Have you considered what might have happened if you hadn't reacted? If you hadn't cried out?
Well, of course I cried out, Maddie blustered. This great oaf stood on my hand. You'd have cried out too.
The great oaf in question, who was, like most rangers, slim in build and below average height, couldn't help smiling at her description of him. He liked Maddie. He had watched her going through her assessments and admired her. He knew that she had to perform at a higher level than the other apprentices because she was a girl, the first to be accepted for ranger training. There were too many people who were ready to dismiss her because of that fact. She couldn't just do as well as the boys in her year. She had to do better.
Merton, said the assessor on the right. What would have happened had Madeline remained silent?
Maddie's captor shrugged.
In all likelihood, I would have continued on. Initially, I thought I'd trodden on a tree root or a fallen branch, he smiled. But then the branch called out, Ow! And I knew I was mistaken.
Maddie's scowl deepened.
Harlan looked from Merton to her once more. Did you think of not reacting? He asked her.
She flushed angrily. I didn't think. He trod on my hand with his great clumsy boot. She paused, then added defiantly, Because he hadn't seen me. Said Harlan thoughtfully.
Goodris, the ranger seated to his right, leaned forward. Tell me, Maddie, he said. What made you choose that field to try to break through the lane? After all, the grass in the adjacent fields was much longer.
She paused, swallowing her anger for a moment, then answered. I figured they'd assume that I'd go through the longer grass, she explained, so the searchers in the low grass wouldn't be as attentive as they might be. Plus, they'd tend to spread out farther. The three assessors exchanged a glance.
Will and Gillen, at the back of the tent, did likewise.
Gillen pursed his lips in an appreciative expression.
That's good thinking, said Downey, the third assessor.
The others grunted assent.
Maddie's marks for tactical planning bore out the choice. Except, Harlan said, deciding that too much praise was not a good thing for this young woman. She was caught.
Only because he stood on me, Maddie flared.
Behind her, Will raised an eyebrow at Gillen as if to say, See what I mean?
Gillen shrugged.
"We've established that that was unfortunate," Harlan said, a trifle briskly. "But it doesn't alter the result."
Maddie heard the change of tone, from even-handed and slightly sympathetic to decisive and final. She realized any further argument could well be counterproductive for her. She had opened her mouth to protest further. Now she shut it firmly. Harlan noticed her capitulation and nodded approval. Then he continued in a more conciliatory tone.
"In any event, Maddie, your performance at this gathering has been exceptional, and I'd like to congratulate you on passing your third-year assessment."
"Hear, hear," murmured Downey and Goodris.
Maddie allowed herself the ghost of a smile, even though her flushed features indicated that she was still annoyed about failing her test by sheer accident.
Harlan looked up at the two senior rangers behind the girl and singled out Will.
"Congratulations to you too, Will Treaty," he said. "Her performance reflects well on your training and guidance."
Will shrugged. "I merely show the way, Harlan," he said. "Maddie follows it. Any success is due to her efforts."
"Quite so," said Harlan,
smiling inwardly at the other man's humility. He looked back to Maddie and took her bronze oak leaf from the tabletop, where she had placed it when the hearing began. He handed it back to her now.
"Here, Maddie. I'm delighted to tell you that you are to advance to your fourth year of training with Ranger Will."
Maddie took the oak leaf and dropped the chain over her head, arranging the small bronze symbol at her throat. Had she failed the year's assessment, the oak leaf would have been marked by a small hole hammered through the brass. If she accumulated three of those throughout her training period, she would be politely asked to leave the Corps. She was proud that her oak leaf, symbol of her rank as an apprentice ranger, was unmarked. Harlan pushed back his chair now and stood, reaching across the table to shake her hand. Goodris and Downey did the same. Maddie shook hands and bowed her head as they congratulated her. She turned to go and found herself facing Merton, the young ranger who had caught her. He too offered his hand.
"Congratulations, Maddie," he said.
She hesitated. She was still angry about the way he had found her. But his smile was genuine, and his manner was friendly. She shook hands with him.
"Thanks,"
she said briefly. And then she gave him a reluctant smile. It was impossible to stay angry with someone as cheerful as he was.
"You should be proud of yourself," he said to her. "One in four apprentices doesn't make it this far. Not without having to repeat a year at least once."
She was too surprised to say anything. She hadn't realized that the failure rate was so high. Will certainly hadn't told her. He hadn't wanted to worry her about the possibility of failure. Not that it was something Maddie ever considered. She relinquished Merton's hand, mumbled a thank you, and turned away to where Will and Gillen were waiting for her. Her mentor drew the tent flap aside and motioned her through ahead of him. He and Gillen followed, and the three of them strode in line abreast through the gathering ground, towards the spot where they had pitched their simple one-person tents. They walked in silence for several minutes. Then Maddie couldn't restrain herself any longer.
"I still say it's not fair," she said quietly.
Will glanced sidelong at her.
"And I imagine you will keep saying so until you do your make-up assessment in 3 months," he said.
There was a note of finality in his tone that warned her not to continue with the matter. Gillen, however, had something to add.
"Maddie, if you really think you've been badly treated, I am obliged to look into the matter. I am the Commandant, after all. Are you making an official complaint here?"
Maddie was aghast at the thought that she might be seen to be invoking the authority of the Corps Commandant.
Good Lord, no, Gillen, she said quickly. I don't think of you as the Commandant.
Well, thank you very much, Gillen said. I'm glad my authority is so negligible.
She hastened to qualify her statement. I mean, I know you're the Commandant, of course, and I respect you for it, but I think of you more as a friend.
Well then, he replied, as a friend, let me advise you. Accept the judgment and let this matter drop. In fact, keep it in mind for the future. You may well be the most accomplished person at Unseen Movement.
Am I? Said Maddie, brightening.
But he simply looked at her for several seconds before replying. I'm saying that as a hypothetical, he said, and she subsided. Her balloon of pride well and truly pricked. But even if you were, he went on, the fact is that accidents and bad luck happen. A little mistake, a little unexpected event, can give you away. Don't forget it.
She thought about his words, then nodded.
You're right, Gillen. I'm sorry. She turned to Will. And I won't go on and on about this when we're home, she said.
Will snorted. That'll be the day.
Before she could reply, Gillen drew their attention to a figure seated comfortably by the fire in front of their three tents.
And unless my eyes deceive me, that would seem to be Holt waiting for us, he said.
Wonder what he wants, Will mused.
I'm sure he'll tell us, Maddie said in a self-satisfied voice. It was the kind of answer Will would give to her if she ever voiced a rhetorical question like that, and she was pleased to have an opportunity to say it to him.
I think I preferred it when you were whining about being trodden on, Will said.
3. Holt looked up as Will, Maddie and Gillen approached the fire. He had just dropped a handful of coffee beans into a pot of water boiling over the coals, and was stirring it with a thin stick.
"Good evening," he said. "I trust you've had a successful day."
"Yes, indeed.
Maddie has passed her assessment and will advance to fourth-year training," Will said.
Holt inclined his head toward her.
"Well, I can't say that was unexpected," he said. "In spite of the ham-fisted mentor you're stuck with."
He smiled as he said the last words. Will chose to ignore them.
"Another perfect score?"
Holt asked, and Maddie scowled.
"Oh, no," Will muttered. "Did you have to ask that?"
Holt's gaze shifted between them, and he raised an interrogative eyebrow.
"Was there a problem?"
"They failed me on Unseen Movement," Maddie said, the anger returning.
Now both Holt's eyebrows shot up.
"How did that happen? I'd seen you, or rather, I haven't seen you, practicing Unseen Movement. You're an expert. You're nearly as good as Gillen."
He smiled at his former apprentice. "Well, technically, I'd passed all right. Nobody saw me. They'd all gone past me when a sweeper trod on my hand."
If she was expecting sympathy from the older ranger, she was disappointed.
He emitted a short bark of decidedly unsympathetic laughter.
"Ah, well, these things do happen," he said. "You can't allow for bad luck."
Maddie drew breath to reply, but Will laid a restraining hand on her forearm.
"Don't say it's not fair again," he cautioned her. "Life isn't always fair, and you have to live with that fact."
His apprentice's protest died stillborn on her lips. She mumbled something under her breath, and he deemed it wiser to pretend he hadn't heard it.
Holt busied himself pouring a mug of coffee, then looked around for the honey jar he knew would be somewhere close to hand.
"It's hanging from that tree branch," Gillen said, pointing to an overhanging limb that stretched out from the mass of oak under which they had pitched their tents. "You didn't expect us to leave it by the fire, where the ants could get at it, did you?"
Maddie reached up and passed the honey to Halt. He spooned a liberal amount into his cup and drank, letting out an of quiet satisfaction when he had done so. While Will poured coffee for himself and Gillen, Halt studied Maddie with an amused expression on his face. "He's mellowed," Gillen thought. Time was, Halt would go for a month on end without letting a smile show on his face. Must be Pauline's influence.
"You know," Halt said, leaning back against the log beside the fire and stretching his legs out, "a similar thing happened to me years ago."
"During your assessment?" Maddie asked.
The old ranger shook his head. "I didn't have an assessment as such," he said. "Crowley just decided my skills were up to scratch and declared I was a ranger."
There was a wistful note in his voice as he mentioned the late commandant. He missed Crowley, who had been his first true friend. Then he resumed his anecdote.
"No, this happened when I was being chased by a band of Temujoy."
"Was that when you stole their horse herd?" Will asked. Halt regarded him with a small frown. Will grinned to himself. Halt didn't like to be reminded that he had stolen a herd of 20 horses from the Temujai, to add their bloodline to the ranger horse-breeding program.
"Let's say I acquired them," Halt said. "I left 150 silver pieces for them, far more than the horses were worth."
"But you didn't actually ask the Temujai if they were willing to sell the horses to you, did you?" Gillen put in. Like Will, he knew Halt's ticklish attitude about the way he had acquired the herd.
"Well, that would have been pointless," Halt admitted. "They never sold their horses."
"So, in fact, you did steal them," Will said, and Halt glared at him.
"Stealing is when you take something without payment," he said. "Something that doesn't belong to you."
"Whether you left money for them or not, you've admitted that the Temujai weren't willing to sell. So, in effect, you stole them," Gillen resumed, barely managing to hide a smile. Halt's eyebrows lowered as he looked from one former apprentice to another.
"I preferred you to when you showed a little respect for your elders," he said.
Will shrugged. "Well, we used to respect you, but then we found out you'd stolen a herd of horses, and it was hard to keep looking up to you after that." Maddie took pity on the white-haired ranger. She liked Halt. He was always a friend to her, and she'd only recently learned that it was he who had been instrumental in changing ranger policy and having a girl admitted to the training program.
"You said something similar happened to you," she reminded him. "Did one of the Temujai tread on you?"
He nodded gratefully to her, glad the subject had been changed. He took a sip of his coffee and resumed his story.
"No, I'd concealed the horses. The ones I'd bought and paid for," he added, with a baleful glance at Gillen. "In a copse of trees. I was going to fetch water from a nearby stream when two Temujai appeared, driving half a dozen goats to the water. They were mounted, of course."
"So one of their horses trod on you?" Maddie asked.
"Which one of us is telling this story?" Halt asked her, and she made an apologetic gesture, encouraging him to go ahead.
He paused, making sure she wasn't about to interrupt again, then continued.
So there I was, lying in the long grass, covered by my cloak.
Just like me, Maddie put in.
Then, seeing his exasperated expression, hastily added,
Sorry, sorry. Please continue.
You're sure?
Holt asked, and she nodded repeatedly, lips pressed tightly together. So there I was, lying on the ground, totally concealed from the Temujai, when a nanny goat started to chew my hair.
Will and Gillen, who had never heard this story before, erupted in laughter.
Maddie grinned, but decided that, in Holt's current mood, it might be best to appear sympathetic.
You should have had your cowl up, Will said.
I did, Holt replied. The damn nanny goat nuzzled it aside and started champing.
Their laughter grew louder. Gillen finally got control of himself and said, straight-faced,
I've often wondered how you came by that haircut. This explains a great deal.
Holt had the reputation in the Ranger Corps of cutting his hair with his sax knife. The results were often ragged and uneven.
So what happened then?
Maddie wanted to know.
Obviously, I leapt up to get away from the nanny goat. The Temujai nearest me was thrown from the saddle when his horse reared in surprise. I grabbed the other one by the leg and tossed him out of the saddle as well. Then I ran for it. I only just got away. Fortunately, Abelard was close by, and he outran their ponies. I circled back for the rest of the horses that night.
He looked steadily at Maddie. The point of this is, accidents happen. People tread on you. Nanny goats chew your hair. You have to be ready for the unexpected. It's all part and parcel of staying hidden. Remember it in future. Learn from this experience. You never know what's going to happen.
Maddie nodded meekly. Yes, Holt. Thank you.
Now, said Holt, turning back to Will and Gillen. Do either of you grinning apes want to ask me what brought me here? Why I've ridden all the way from Castle Redmond and my cosy fireplace to visit you.
Holt had been an irregular visitor to the gathering this year.
He had coached some of the younger apprentices, helping them improve their shooting technique. And from time to time, he had assessed them in various tasks. But that side of his activity had ended as the gathering came to a close.
Gillen shrugged. I assume you came for the farewell ceremony.
Holt nodded. Well, that's true. But that's not until tomorrow. A dispatch came for you from Horace. I thought I'd better bring it out, since nobody at Redmond knew where the gathering ground was.
The gathering ground moved each year, and its exact whereabouts were kept a strict secret. The Ranger Corps had made many enemies over the years, and some of them would have been keen to know where the entire Corps would be for these 2 weeks.
Holt reached inside his vest and brought out a rolled scroll, held with a ribbon, which was in turn sealed with a large blob of wax. He passed it to Gillen, who studied the seal, recognizing Horace's symbol.
Have you read it?
He asked Holt. The old ranger was notorious for his ability to open and reseal communications. He had an extensive kit of instruments with which he could lift wax seals without disturbing the impression or breaking the wax. And, in case of accidents, he also kept a stock of counterfeit seals with which he could replace the original. They weren't always exact replicas, but they were close enough to fool most people at a cursory glance. Holt looked affronted.
It's sealed,
he said, with some dignity. Will grinned to himself as he realized that Hort hadn't actually answered the question.
"When has that ever stopped you?"
Gillen muttered, breaking the seal and unrolling the parchment sheet to read it. After a few seconds, he glanced up at Maddie.
"Your dad sends his love," he said. "He hopes you're doing well at your assessments."
Maddie smiled. Typical of her father. He would send her a personal message, even in an official communication. She and Horace had a close relationship, which had become even closer when she began training as a ranger. It took her further into her father's world, and gave them a lot in common. Gillen went back to the dispatch, frowning slightly as he read on. "Bad news?" Will asked, noticing the frown. Gillen waved the question aside, waiting till he'd finished reading the message. Then he looked up, fixing his gaze on Hort. "Have you heard anything about a group called the Red Fox Clan?" Hort made a small moo.
"Not a great deal. Anarchists, aren't they?"
Gillen shook his head. "A bit more than that. We've been getting reports about them at Castle Araluin for some months now. They're a group who oppose the current laws of succession to the throne. They want to revert to a patriarchal system." Araluin law said that any true descendant, male or female, could inherit the throne. Thus, in the event of Duncan's death, Cassandra would become queen and ruler in her own right. Horace would not become king simply because he was married to her. He would be her consort. And in time, Maddie would inherit the throne from her mother. But if the Red Fox Clan had their way, the kingdom would revert to an old law, where the throne could be passed down only to a male descendant. If this happened, it would throw the current succession into chaos. "Any reason why they feel that way?" Will asked. Gillen shrugged. "Most likely because someone wants to use it as a pretext for taking the throne himself," he said. "In any event, they mean trouble for Cassandra and Maddie here, and Horace thinks it's time we put a stop to it."
"What's he got in mind?" Will asked.
He noticed that Hort wasn't asking questions, which seemed to indicate that he had read the dispatch.
"We finally located their headquarters near the east coast," Gillen said. "Horace plans for him and me to take a company of troops and put an end to their nonsense once and for all."
He hesitated, looking at the other two rangers. "At the same time, there are rumours that another group of them has formed on Redmond's northwest border. He's asked if you two will investigate, see what they're up to, and bring them to heel as well."
"So, you'll be heading back to Castle Araluin tomorrow?" Hort asked.
Gillen regarded him, head cocked to one side.
"That's what it says here," he said, tapping the dispatch.
"But how could you have known that?" Hort smiled.
"Just a lucky guess," he said.
4. The closing ceremony of the gathering was always a bittersweet affair. The rangers and their apprentices gathered for a farewell banquet, with kitchen and serving staff brought in from Castle Redmond and its adjoining village. Now that the gathering was almost over, there was no need to keep the location a secret. It would be moved somewhere else the following year. The rangers feasted and talked long into the night, until the poignant moment when they joined together to sing their traditional farewell song, "Cabin in the Trees." Rangers lived a dangerous, adventurous life, and there was no knowing how many of those assembled here would be present in a year's time. So they mingled and embraced and wished each other well
and looked deep into one another's eyes, knowing that, in some cases, this could be the last time they saw their comrades. Gillen had decided to stay for the ceremony, in spite of originally declaring his intention to